people talking right about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight, old man, you're switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fallen dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fallen dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Lots of news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots of news. Things are happening really, really quickly. And lots of very interesting commentary. Let's see, where should we start first? The very good commentary by a man I've known since 1968. His name is Jeff Goodall. He is used to be a trade unionist and bravely stood up within the union for anti-communism, for sensible policies, for fairness, white rights, and it was one of those brave people who worked within the system to try to improve things. And of course, he's been retired for a few years. He's now quite a dedicated blogger, and this is something he wrote about the incredible controversy that occurred over the efforts by the politically correct, by the cultural Marxists, including the mayor of Toronto. I don't know if he's a cultural Marxist or just a coward and an idiot, but to try to shut down the meeting last week for Barbara Kolaska. Now, this was a memorial, and you might ask, well, why would somebody want to shut down a memorial in a public library? Well, you see, Barbara had defended some controversial people, including myself, a man named Ernst Zundel. She was part of his defense team in the second Zundel trial for false news back in 1988. It's a case which eventually went to the Supreme Court and the law was overturned, like a big victory. She was also an associate with Doug Christie in the Imre Fintech trial, and that was the trial of a man who was accused of war crimes. He was actually one of the first people tried under Canada's notorious war crime law, brought in the late 1980s at the behest of the Canadian Jewish Congress by the cowardly pro-Zio supporter Brian Mulroney, the so-called conservative prime minister. Well, by the time Doug Christie and Barbara Kalasher got through with the Zundel trial, they went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Canadian war crimes law was essentially gutted. Not completely repealed or ruled unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court agreed that the defense of following orders was a legitimate defense. Now, that's not following any orders. You know, if your commanding officer tells you, let's say, to take a baby and hold it by the baby's feet and smash its head out against a wall, that's not a legitimate order. But Imre Fintan was not charged with, ordered to commit an obvious crime like that. He was ordered to transport Jews who'd been arrested in Budapest in the spring of 1944 to trains that were taking them somewhere he didn't know where. Now, it was wartime. How could he know where? They don't tell. Orders are not given where you're given the complete picture. An order is usually very specific and very limited. Do this. And the order in and of itself was entirely legitimate. Finta had no way to know where these people were going. It's alleged some of them went to Auschwitz. It's alleged some of them died. And was Finta in a position to know that? Well, of course not. Anyway, he argued quite legitimately that he was under orders. He was a police captain. He was ordered by his legitimate superiors to move these people from one point to another. He did. And in the end, the Supreme Court had to recognize that following orders, with some limitations, was a legitimate defense. Well, that basically sank this very nasty war crimes piece of legislation, because the whole idea was that Canada would prosecute people who had not been Canadian citizens, or actually we're not Canadian subjects or Canadian citizens, for actions they did in another country over which we had no jurisdiction, to people over whom we had no jurisdiction. This is the ultimate in judicial reaching. But those were the times in the Jewish lobby then, as now, running rampant over people's rights. And it was a huge victory. Now, Barbara Kalasher would go on to defend many other people. And while she was less well-known and less flamboyant than Doug Christie, who was really, I mean, these trials, the voice that the public heard, she was nonetheless incredibly effective. And she was a really important person. So we had a memorial for Canadian Association for Free Expression. That's kind of by way of introducing this elitist venom over free speech lawyers remembrance service. Memorial service draws controversy July 13th. That was a headline. Jeff Goodall says, I find it astonishing that such vitriol should be poured out over a remembrance service for a member of the legal profession who passed away so tragically and at such a relatively young age, actually 64. She broke no laws in her representation of persons whose opinions were not politically correct, and her actions were no more reprehensible than those of criminal lawyers who specialize in representing those accused of breaking the criminal code. Robert Kalashka's professional activities were of considerable assistance in breaking the anti-democratic stranglehold over free speech exercised by the notorious Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. And we owe her a debt of gratitude for that. Jeff Goodall wrote to the Toronto Star on July the 16th. The absolute deluge of vile hatred and venom over Barbara Kalashka's over Barbara Kalashka's remembrance meeting at Toronto's Richview Public Library shows the fanatical intolerance and loathing the politically correct elites have for anyone daring to disagree with their point of view. It's been said that leftists always express their firm belief in the rights of others to hold different opinions, but then go into a state of severe shock, followed by rage, when they discover to their amazement that there are, in fact, other opinions. Far too many columns and editorials have spewed out on this issue for me to list them all, but I will identify four of them. One in the Toronto Star, quoting victimhood professional Bernie Farber, which is far better than his column in the Toronto Sun, by the way, one by none other than Elise Hadigan of Race Trader fame. That was a book she wrote. She was writing in the Canadian Jewish News, and particularly noteworthy for her vicious stereotypical hyperbole in the Toronto Sun, and that was Liz Braun. Plus, there's an interesting item from the National Post worthy noting. Bernie Farber rather conclusively states that Barbara Kalashka was a fellow traveler in this country. She provided legal counsel to neo-Nazis, racists, and bigots, and in fact ensured through some of the work that she did that hate laws and neo-Nazis and even Nazi war criminals would not be prosecuted in this country. And why should they be? Whether you are a Nazi or a neo-Nazi or a communist, why should you be prosecuted for the non-violent espousal of your political views? And of course, this neo-Nazi stuff is so much hooey. Neo-Nazi is really a term of abuse used against people who have a variety of views, perhaps skepticism about one of the greatest imposed religions of our time, and that is the so-called Holocaust, the Holocaust. So if you question that, you're a neo-Nazi. And I want to emphasize something I mentioned before, but it's quite important. I have a very long political career going back actively to probably 1963. I have very seldom met anybody who identified himself, if you ask, okay, well, what are your views or what are your politics? I'm a neo-Nazi. The only time I've met such people are people who are either infiltrators or very young and ill-advised. Literally, a neo-Nazi is a new Nazi. I've known a number of national socialists, and I have not known any who would presume to improve upon the ideas of the founder of the National Socialist Party in Germany, Adolf Hitler. None of these people would have called themselves neo-Nazis. Also, Nazi was a term of abuse in the 1930s by the enemies of the National Socialist Party. It was roughly the equivalent of Bubba in the United States. Nazi referred to, it was a short form for Ignaz, and Ignaz is your stereotypical slow-witted country bumpkin, or in American terms, a Bubba. Well now, would you call yourselves Bubbas? I mean, seriously, you mean it might be maybe self-mockery or humor, you might, but would you? Well, no, you wouldn't. I mean, why would you call yourself something derogatory? Anyway, but this term is tossed around widely and wildly. And Jeff Goodall continues, surely the successes that he accuses her of clearly demonstrate that the courts, up to and including the Supreme Court of Canada, very often agreed with her well-argued cases. You need to do better than that, Bernie. Saying that her legacy is one, if she has one, is one of increasing and permitting hatred in Canada, is obviously the sour grapes whining of a loser. And more than that, it's what he calls hatred. And, well, first of all, I would say you ought to have the right to hate. Well, you don't have the right to go and punch somebody in the face, but you have the right to strongly dislike someone or something. In fact, The Bible itself endorses so-called hate. Now, that's not the same thing as justifying somebody assaulting somebody. Well, I mean, let's make that quite clear. Anyway, back to Jeff's excellent column. The Hadigan's item is headed by a photo of an Aryan Guard street action in Calgary 10 years ago. And the article quoting Farber and the National Post is headed with a photo of three masked toughs dressed in black who stood outside the street from the library. But we're not participants, and yet the caption to the photo made you think they were attending the meeting. And I would say by their ugly presence, if you did not know the situation better, you might think somehow they were associated with the meeting, which they were not. They were trying to stop it until the police stopped them. And Jeff Goodall continues, they refused to identify themselves, never tried to enter, and may well have been planted to create a false atmosphere of potential violence in hopes that this would cause the meeting to be canceled. That may well be. While Hadigan does little more than rehash her Race Traitor, that's a book she wrote. She said she'd been a member briefly of the Heritage Front back in the early 1990s, and they manipulated and used her because she was a poor, lonely Romanian girl, probably a gypsy from a broken family, and they were the only ones who would pay any attention to her, but they just used her and manipulated her and turned her into a hater, etc., etc. She has since become a lesbian. Anyway, that's her story, and she's sticking to it. Let me tell you a personal experience with Miss Hadigan. It would be, I think, 1992. And we, that's the Canadian Association for Free Expression and a number of other free speech supporters, gathered on the steps of the ancient Toronto Dawn Jail, because Ernst Zundel had had to turn himself in on the eve of, and I believe this was the announcement of his appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. I believe that was it. No, I think the arguing of his appeal. And that's part of the legal procedure in Canada. Even if you're on bail, when your case is about to be appealed, when the appeal is about to be heard, you have to turn yourself in. Well, Ernst did. And we were there as strong and silent witness to freedom of speech, denouncing the sort of country that would have laws making spreading false news a criminal offense. I mean, there's always, anyway, that's another story, and it's what we want. But there we were on the front steps of the court. There must have been, I would think, 30 or 40 of us. And with us was Elise Hadigan, who back then might have been 16, 17. And Elise was walking beside me. And a negress came up the steps with a young, her child, a little boy. I'm bad on ages of women and children, but he was walking, so I'm going to say he was maybe 3. And she walked up the steps, walked past us, and was going into the prison, I guess, to visit the prisoner. Well, Elise turned to me and said, I'd like to smash that little nigger. I'd like to break his bones. I'd like to smash them on the concrete here, kick his head and kill him. Now, sometimes young people, sometimes people, I would say, overspeak themselves. And say, especially if they're drunk. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to go and do this and that, something else. So I'm used to that kind of talk. Well, she wasn't drunk. And I was the only audience that's not trying to impress a crowd. And I looked into her eyes, and I think she meant it. Now, I think that was sick. No, I don't like Negroes in my country, and I had no particular use for this woman and her child, but I don't want to see people killed, and I don't want like this idea of just smashing and brutalizing a child, or an adult for that matter. And I thought, that's sick. And I mentioned that to Ernst Zundel, and he told me, I mentioned to him when he got out of prison, some days later, a couple weeks later, and he said to me, that was the impression he had of her, and he warned Wolfgang Droger, who was the head of the Heritage Front at the time, to be very careful of her, that she was a disturbed young woman and would cause trouble. Well, she did cause trouble.
among other things, she turned traitor and wrote the book Race Traitor and so on, supposedly telling the secrets of the Heritage Front and how she was converted from racism to anti-racism and she's become a lesbian and all that. I have no idea whether this is a true conversion or not, or she's just a badly mixed up person. But that was the impression I got of her, that she was a badly mixed up and badly disturbed person. I mean, it's one thing to say, I don't like these people in my country. Fair enough, I don't like them either in my country. But to want to, you know, pulverize, brutalize, and murder a child, that's over the top. Anyway, let's get down with Miss Hannigan now that she's a 39 or 40 year old lesbian has to say. She says, I don't think he's going to say, Jeff is going to say much about what she says. He's going to go to Liz Braun, who's a columnist for the Toronto Sun, who just went into a rant against us. Braun goes to town with such James's Kalashka's thing was freedom of speech issues. It's a widely held view that she was philosophically on side with many of her clients. Well, even if she was, so what? Braun offers no evidence. And she refers to the attendees. And this was, I would say, if we really cared what Miss Braun had to say, I guess we might have been hurt by this. But she's a pathetic pencil pusher, I guess. This is the way she described as the attendees. These pathetic, anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-female, homophobic, Islamophobic, etc., garden variety bigots. And Jeff continues, and while harping on Mayor John Tory's deep concern, she fails to mention that his involvement was, according to a number of mainstream media reports, actively solicited by Jewish interests. But, you know, bien certainement, that's the way it goes. The Jewish lobby is so used to getting its own way and ordering spineless politicians around that I think they were flabbergasted that they didn't win this one. And shows the depth of Tory's commitment to freedom. Jeff goes on to say, I don't doubt at all that Kalashka's work editing Zundel's book, Did 6 Million Really Die?, was a professional engagement intended to avoid legal problems arising from the wording of the book. There is no reason to believe she agreed with the contents or that she did anything other than check it over and edit it for legal risks to her client. Well, actually, not to disagree with Jeff here, but yes, I've got to clarify. Did 6 Million Really Die? The book to which he's referring is not the original book by a man named Harwood. It is, in fact, the name given to a book containing that book and all the legal documents and testimony of the second Zundel trial. In fact, its subtitle is the documents and evidence in the Zundel trial of 1988. It's not a polemic, it's basically an excellently prepared and edited and organized resource. In his article, Far Rights and Right Extremists Converge at Memorial for Toronto Lawyer in the National Post on July the 12th, which was headed with another photo of the unidentified goons, Joseph Breen observes that Kalashka, who died last month, age 64, but whose death was not publicized until Tuesday, is famous among the Canadian far right for winning acquittals under the law for people charged with hate crimes or even undoing the laws used to charge them. She was largely responsible, for example, for the fact that Canada has no law against false news and no human rights ban on internet hate speech. And for that fact, no Nazi has been convicted in Canada of war crimes. Kalashka was a credit to her profession who served her clients well. Jeff Goodall. And he's quite right. That is one of the reasons they hate her. Now, it would be unfair not to to note that she was not solely responsible for these victories. In fact, heading up the team was Doug Christie in both these cases. But she certainly deserves her very fair share of the credit. And that's why they detest her. And I suspect had the memorials we had held in Toronto, in London, Ontario, in Edmonton, and in Vancouver for Doug Christie, had they become known to the enemies of free speech and free thought, there would have been protests there too. It's worth just reflecting on what it was these protesters, including the mayor of the city of Toronto, these people who want to shut the event down, were really saying that you should not be allowed to use a public library, which incidentally we all pay for, and that's a point I made again and again. This is not a privilege being somehow granted to us. This is our right. We paid for it. Hey, it's my library. In fact, and I didn't say this at the time, I'll certainly say it on this program, we actually have a better right to it than many of the people who are protesting, who are Jews who came after the Second World War. My parents on both, I mean, my family's on both sides of the family, both mother and father, have paid taxes in the Dominion of Canada far longer than these people were in this country. In fact, on my mother's side, we go back to the 1650s. On my mother's side, we were among the original habitants, or French settlers, of what's now the province of Quebec, which is then New France. This is our country. We put into it, long before it even was a Dominion of Canada, that public library was paid for by the taxes my family paid, and of course many others. How dare they try to tell us who may and may not use those facilities? I mean, within reason, obviously, if people are going to be rowdy or smash the books fair enough, but to hold a quiet meeting by invitation only, to behind closed doors, how dare they say? It might be hate, which, you know, is the ultimate in presumption. We had people, including the mayor of Toronto, pretending to know what was going to be done or said there. It's a memorial. That's what we told them. And there was a senior manager of the library who monitored the meeting, took notes, and so on. And I'm sure that would be what his report was. It was a memorial with people saying nice personal things about Barbara, their recollections, and so on. Hate? No hate there. Frankly, though, even if there had been, that ought to be legal. You ought to be able to express an opinion, any opinion you like. That's what intellectual freedom's about. But the fact that the debate could actually have occurred because she was, okay, controversial, or let's say she was unpopular with people who hate freedom. The Canadian Jewish lobby, the groups that protested, I think it was the Friends of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and certainly Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, Bernie Farber, who used to be with the Canadian Jewish Congress, and it's now more morphed into the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. These are people who have, and of course, Richard Warman from Ottawa, and Warren Kinsella in Toronto. Kinsella's not a Jew, but close ally of the Jewish lobby. These people hated her views. And fair enough, nobody's asking them to like her or approve of her. But the effort, even in death, to slap her down, to hurt her, I think stood out and will stand out as a reproach. And we will continue to rub their noses in the dung that they have deposited in our civilization. Well, this is Paul Frommann. You're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Going to take a short musical interlude here, and I've been playing songs from Northern Ireland or Ulster. And I want to give a bit of an introduction. The 12th last week was, that was the night of the Barbara Kolaska meeting, and both in the run-up and the immediate aftermath, I think I was a little bit lax in noting some of the important dates that or celebrations there were last week. I did, of course, mention the 14th of July, the French Revolution, which we have to recognize, although most of us don't like it, but also the 12th of July, which has played a big role in the politics of England and to some extent in the politics of Canada, maybe not so much today, but in years gone by. July the 12th commemorated the victory of William of Orange, who was a Dutch dwarfish monarch, possibly a homosexual, who defeated the Catholic would-be King James II in Ireland, and the key battle was on the 12th of July, 1690, at the Battle of the Boyne. And this was the battle that decided that for the next, first of all, that the English monarchy would not revert to Catholicism, that it would remain Protestant. James II was a Catholic, and that Ireland would remain under essentially Protestant domination, and Northern Ireland's Protestants would be triumphant. So you'll hear in these songs about the Orange Sash, the Orange Order, and those are loyalists. Orange, of course, was the color of William of Orange, the Dutchman who became the King of England. Although it's simplified today as Catholic versus Protestant, at the time it wasn't quite that simple. James II was actually related to William of Orange, and the Pope was in this conflict between Catholic James and Protestant William backed, this is not a trick question, he actually backed William of Orange. Why? Well, as they say in romance, on the dating sites, and in politics, it's complicated. And it was complicated because backing James was Louis XIV, the so-called Sun King of France, who had huge European ambitions of the Pope wish to curb. Okay, that's the historical background. Here are a couple of songs celebrating that victory at the Battle of the Boyne, and this is this is King Billy's on the Wall. That's of course William of Orange, and we're going to try to call the song up. I think. Yep, King Billy's on the Wall.
There's a famous painting now that everybody knows. It stands upon a gable wall over Sandy Low, in memory of King William and brother Louis Joy. They fought for our deliverance at the Battle of the Boyne. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him. They stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, there are slogans painted in red, white, and blue. They tell the Pope where he can go and what he can do. There's one big gel and rice. Well, that's a different class. Go stick the lower arm around and stick it up your ass. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. Well, the next time you're an Ulster, won't you come and have a look? Stand beside that girl and have your photo too. Then put it on your mantelpiece or hang it in your hall, so that all the world can see King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright, he lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him, they stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Billy's on the wall. King Billy's on the wall, King Billy's on the wall.
He stands so high, he shines so bright. He lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him. They stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690, King Pele's on the wall. King Pele's on the wall. He stands so high, he shines so bright. He lights up the falls. There's millions come to see him. They stand and gaze in awe. They remember 1690. King Pele's on the wall.
That's King Pele's on the wall, of course, referring to William of Orange. Next song we're going to play is called Bury Me Under the Red Hand. Now, the red hand is the symbol of Ulster. It's a palm facing outwards. It's red. And this is called Bury Me Under the Red Hand. Well, it's a-coming, and so is Christmas, we hope. Bury Me Under the Red Hand. Quite sure we are having so much trouble with the media, but this goes with the territory, unfortunately. I'm going to try to call that up in just a minute. Instead, I'm going to play a very bitter song that comes from the First World War experience of Ulster. I think we're about to get Bury Me Under the Red Hand. Are we? Perhaps we'll have better luck with an Englishman's command. This refers to the bitterness after the term. We really are having our problems. This is, we hope, I'm still trying to get bury me under the red hand. There we are.
Mother heard the news on the my son, oh my son, she did cry. And she sighed when the last words were spoken, for her son was a hero when I. Will you bury me yonder the red line? Will you bury me yonder the jack? Will you bury me yonder the red line? My fighting for Ulster. Will you bury me under the red line? Will you bury me under the jack? Will you bury me under the red line? For fighting for Ulster. My fighting for Ulster is gone.
And that's Bury Me Under the Red Hand, of course, the symbol of Ulster. Final song I'm going to play is a very bitter song that reflects the experience of Ulster in the First World War. It's not the song I want to play. The First World War, when Britain went to war and the call went out for volunteers, Ulster volunteered, the people in Ulster volunteered in great numbers and formed the 36th Division of the British Army that fought valiantly and nobly and took tremendous casualties, especially on July the 1st, 1916, at the Battle of the Somme, and that's the song makes reference to that, but also the feeling at the end of the war, because there was a considerable pressure in Southern Ireland for independence from England in the Catholic South, and by 1922 a deal had been worked out by which the southern 26 counties of Ireland were given independence, including three that many of the Protestants in Northern Ireland felt belonged to them, and hence the reference to where there had been nine, there are now only six, and I am still trying to find this song, which is Under an Englishman's Command, and we're going to have to give that another try, but we're going to find this. It's a great song, and underlines some of the bitterness that there is in Ulster. Both sides, of course, the Catholic and Protestant, feel somewhat betrayed, and perhaps for different reasons. Okay, let's see if we can't call this one up. Here it is, Under an Englishman's Command. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me, here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
My comrades, on the 1st of July morning, when Ulster men are rightly proud of a land where they were born, I'll tell you of our volunteers and how it came to pass. As they went to fight for England's cause, far away from old Belfast, it was in the dark, uncertain days of early World War I, when England's shores were threatened by the jihad boot of the Hun. When England's cry for help was heard, we bid her not no fear. For across the Flanders fields we will send our Ulster volunteers. It was our place they call the Somme on the first day of July, when 20,000 Ulster men prepared to fight and die. Sure they bravely charged through no man's land with the rain and flying high. With the cry of no surrender, boys, all Ulster's battle cries. Now those Germans in their trenches deep, good scares believe they rise. When up and charge those Ulster men and hear their battle cries. What kind of men are those, they said, who would leave their native land just to die upon this battlefield? And what is that strange red hand? On and on they fought that day, where others feared to tread. And on the wire and in the mud, they lay behind their dead. But the only flag to fly that day behind those German lines was the old red hand of Ulster, with dogs around her name. Now those who lived came home again. What changes did they all find? For the counties that made Ulster up no longer numbered nine. Three counties had been sold away by those they fought to save. Yes, this
was England's gratitude for the sacrifice they made.
So gather round, my comrades, on the spurs of July morn, when Ulster men are rightly proud of a land where they were born. For they'll never more be led away to fight in foreign land, or to die for someone else's cause at an English man's command, or die for someone else's cause at an English man's command.
As I said, a rather bitter song reflecting the disappointment after so much blood and sacrifice that many people in Ulster felt that when England had been in need, they had answered the call, and for political expediency, their interests were ignored right after the war. An ongoing and problem, and we're going to have another great song, but I think we would like to move on. Yes, I play that tomorrow night. Anyway, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me. Probably caught that story, at least I hope you did, of a Somali cop in Minneapolis who gunned down an Australian tourist. And she had called 911, I believe, and she had a police car rolled up. Driving it was a white policeman. And in the passenger seat was this Somali policeman who probably was an affirmative action hire. His community was very proud of him. The police were showing him around as part of their community outreach. You know, all the usual malarkey. Well, for reasons best known to himself, he pulled out his gun and, reaching across his partner, don't forget, his partner has driven the car, and speaking to the partner through the window is this Australian woman, blonde, beautiful Australian woman. He pulls the trigger and shoots her through the stomach and kills her. Now, she doesn't have a weapon. She's not arguing. She's not menacing his partner. Absolutely incomprehensible what he was doing, why he did this, but he shot and killed her. Well, the politically correct are in full, denial mode, trying to, how do you explain the unexplainable? And how do you defend the undefendable? Well, of course, they're going to have to try. In discussing this on another program last night, and I do invite you to listen every night from 9 o'clock, every weeknight rather, from 9 until 10, that's Eastern Standard Time, is the Trump phenomenon on Republic Broadcasting. That's rbn.org. And that's at 9 o'clock every weeknight at Eastern Standard Time. We were talking about this last night, and all three hosts, myself, Jamie Kelso, and George from Maryland, all were furious at what had happened. Again, we won't mention any particular group, but certainly the Somalis who came to North America after the Civil War, or at least, let's say, after the third last episode of the Civil War back in the early 90s, it came from a drug and gun culture, an extremely violent culture. In fact, the reason for United Nations intervention, of which the Americans were part in the, and a movie made about that was Black Hawk Down. The reason was that the various clans in Somalia were trying to deny one another food shipments sent in by the United Nations. Somalia was undergoing a famine, largely man-made because of the the Civil War, terrible policies, and so on. They were actually trying to beggar their neighbors, starve each other out. And for that reason, I think completely foolishly, but for that reason, the United Nations wanted to intervene and ensure the delivery of food. I thought we'd just dump it on the shore, and it's up to you people. If you want to do these things to yourself, you're an independent country, do it. But anyway, that was not the way things were done. And so it's out of that country that we get these so-called refugees that have been quite numerous in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area, in Toronto, and in Ottawa in Canada. And it's been a bad experience. Many of these people remain on welfare a quarter of a century after they came. But what do you expect? They come from a drug and gun culture. They are probably the second most active group in the drug trade in Toronto, after the Jamaicans. But what do you expect? They come from a drug and gun culture. And add to that, under multiculturalism, they are encouraged to, keep your culture. Your culture is as good as ours. Well, it might even be better than ours, for all we know. They are not ruthlessly told, look, you get with the agenda, you assimilate, or else we'll send you back. No. I mean, once you agree to the preposterous dogmas of multiculturalism, that all cultures are equal. How do we know that? Well, we know that because these people chose to come here. Why did they come halfway around the world here? Because they come from a failed state. It's a failed state because of a failed culture. Why would we encourage them for one nanosecond to keep that failed culture, to bring that failed culture here so it can fail here and perhaps mess up the society we have here? Well, no way. No possible way should that ever have been allowed. However, it was. And perhaps we will know more in the days ahead as to what might have been going through that Somali cop's mind. Was he simply trigger happy? Did he not like whites and she was as good a one as any to gun down? There was no threat to him. She had no weapon. She wasn't menacing his partner. If anything, his partner, if there had been a threat, should have been the one to react, but he didn't. He didn't because there was no threat. I think we have got to make the politically correct own their mistake. They did it. He's theirs. And this is one of the many, many problems with affirmative action. And it assumes nonsense. It assumes that the people who all cultures are equal, but they're not. When you assume that, you end up with terrible results. And that's exactly what happened, with tragic results in Minneapolis yesterday. And I think this is something that we have got to just rigorously push out there and say they've got to wear it. You know, all too often, I don't think we're nearly aggressive enough in holding them to account for their numerous mistakes and nonsense. This is Paul Cromin, you're on the fighting side of me here on whiteresistanceradio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.